Video games are everywhere. The industry continues to grow, and the games themselves do serve a purpose.
They help us develop a challenge mindset, which means that we are confident in our ability to get better.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll meet a game designer who creates games that educate and heal. We'll also hear about a new cybersecurity task force in Florida and spend an academic minute going on a virtual reality job interview. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. It could be a bit of hyperbole to say video games saved Jane McGonigal's life, but one that she developed did help her heal from a serious injury. That game is called Super Better, and that's also the name of her latest book. To understand how Jane McGonigal feels about video games, look no further than the title of her first book, Reality is Broken: Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. In naming her one of the 20 most important women in video gaming, Gama Sutra said Jane McGonigal, game designer, researcher, and alternative reality game specialist, is now a futurist working on how games we play can change the way we experience the real world. You can hear her talk about how games can make the world a better place on several TED Talks. I recently spoke to McGonigal and asked about her origin story in gaming and game design.
You know, I was lucky enough to be the first person in the world to try to study at a psychological and cognitive level how the video games that we play change how we respond to stress and challenge in everyday life. I got my PhD in that research area, and I have been studying games and making games to try to have a positive impact on people's real lives ever since.
And games are so easy to attack, and you hear it all the time by politicians and people in the media, but you say games make us the best version of ourselves. Tell us what you mean by that.
They can make us the best version of ourselves. There are some pitfalls, and we can talk about that you want to avoid. But the main thing that video games do, especially for young people, is they help us develop a challenge mindset, which means that we are confident in our ability to learn new skills, to develop new strategies, to get better at things that we are not good at the first time we try them. And this makes really intuitive sense. If you think about any game, it's designed for you to be bad at it the first time you try it, whether it's golf or chess or Fortnite. And playing a game is really about the pleasure of getting better, of mastering new skills and exploring different strategies, and it builds both the confidence in your own ability to get better through your own effort and attention, but it also builds the neurological pathways that allow your brain to respond to challenge and stress in a more positive way so that you're not dealing with anxiety. You are actually feeling energized by the opportunity to do something that's hard and to do something that allows you to get better.
And you say that most games will not give you a challenge that you are not skilled to master, right?
Well, that's just about right. Actually, what games do is they try to give you a challenge that is just fractionally beyond your current level, whether it's The first time you play a game, you are going to have a moment where you're confused or frustrated as you try to figure out that very first step. Or as you get better and you level up or you're playing against more difficult opponents, you're always being stretched to grow just a little bit. And it's why, you know, grown-ups don't play tic-tac-toe unless they're forced to by five-year-olds. Because once you stop learning and growing in a game, it gets boring and we don't play it anymore. Once you've sort of figured out every possible optimal move and there's nothing left to learn, you move on to a new game. And so video games are great in that either the levels can get more challenging, new content can get more difficult, or you just can find new players that are better than you and force you to continue to adapt and grow.
When you set out to develop a new game, how do you approach it, story or skill?
That's really interesting. So the games that I create are usually designed to solve a specific problem for a player. So the game that I'm most famous for, Super Better, I actually developed it to help me heal from a traumatic brain injury. I had a severe concussion that was not healing properly, and I was extremely depressed and anxious and had all the symptoms of vertigo and memory loss and nausea and migraines. And so I created a game around the goal of how can I get my brain to fire up all of those optimistic pathways, that motivated pathways that I used to have in normal life before the injury, so that I can kind of get back out of bed and re-engage with daily life, even though it may be harder than it used to be. Can I bring that gameful mindset where I'm not just feeling anxious or depressed by the challenge, but actually feel like I can rise to the occasion? And so that game, you know, it started with essentially a neurological skill. What will force my brain to fire up those pathways, which tend to shut down when you have a traumatic brain injury or concussion, because your brain wants you to lie in bed and not hit itself again so that you stay healthy and recover. But that can lead to a lot of really dark mental health issues. So for me, when I design a game, I'm really thinking about what's the end result I want to have on the psychological health of the player or the cognitive skills of the player, and then using the research literature and also just my own intuition as a game designer to make sure that whatever we're doing is fun and interesting.
How important is the storyline then?
You know, the real story of any game is the story of the player's journey. So, you know, you take a game like Fortnite and the stories that players tell about it, it's not about the mythology of the universe. It's about what that player decided to do, the action that they took, the strategy they created, the collaboration that they entered into with their team members. So I think with games, the most important stories are the stories you can tell about yourself, stories about, you know, it was unbelievable pressure that I was under and I came up with this crazy idea and I tried it and it worked, or, you know, I was there for my team members, we were just about out of the match and I came in with this crazy move at the last minute, I was totally able to help and save the day. That story that we tell is really about ourselves, and it allows us to really reflect on our own positive strengths. And so I always encourage, you know, people when they think about gaming narrative, the story within the game is never going to be as important as the story that the player gets to tell about their own determination and creativity and teamwork.
You spoke about your game Super Better. There's now a book, Super Better, you just came out with, right?
Yeah, there is a book version, it goes into all of the science behind how games can strengthen our real-life skills and abilities, whether it's in the sort of mental and cognitive area or social area or emotional area. And that was really a lot of fun to write because it gave me a chance to really dig deep and explain, you know, how could a game help people with such serious challenges like anxiety, depression, or traumatic brain injury? And it was really a great opportunity to say, wow, there are literally 500 peer-reviewed scientific papers that can help us understand exactly what's happening in our brains and in our relationships when we play games together.
What are alternative reality games?
So there's a genre of game that is really intentionally designed to bring games off of our screens and out into real spaces. Some of the games that I worked on years ago when I was first designing games, they were the first games to be using GPS so that we would know where in the world you were, so that we could give you something to do in the real world based on whether you were near a payphone that you could answer and solve a puzzle, or you could go to a park and meet up with other players and do a creative challenge. And if you think about Pokemon Go, that's really the best example of where that genre of games has evolved, where now you can go out into the real world and move around in real spaces and have this wonderful face-to-face social interaction with your real-life friends and family and with other people in your community. But we're really trying to make sure that games are firmly embedded in our everyday lives and everyday spaces so that it's not just about escaping, but it's really about engaging with the real world in more fun and positive ways.
When you see something like Pokemon Go, do you sit back and say, geez, I wish I'd thought of that?
Oh, you know, it's amazing. When Pokemon Go, the phenomenon, first happened, I was just celebrating because my first book, Reality is Broken, which I published, I think, 5 years before Pokemon Go came out, I was talking about what the future of games could be, you know, what we could all experience if we brought games out into the real world and more embedded in our real relationships and real lives. And so to have made that kind of a future forecast and to see it play out was really fulfilling for me personally. And I still play it every day with my daughters. I have twin daughters. And so we are living the future, and I'm really happy about that.
Just a quick aside, aren't you a twin also?
I am a twin, and actually that's sort of my secret superpower, because while I was doing my PhD studying video games, she was doing her PhD studying psychology at Stanford right across the bay while I was at Berkeley. And so I think that was really able to help kind of get me into the pipeline of the cutting edge research and kind of combine our wisdom to really understand what is going on in games.
So one of your goals, and do you see this happening, are we solving real-world problems with games?
Yeah, I mean, my biggest goal right now is I'm developing a series of future forecasting games that allow people to better anticipate the long-term consequences of new technologies. So, you know, what if Facebook had been able to foresee fake news 10 years ago? What if Twitter had been able to foresee the kinds of social media bullying that has become common? What if Apple had been able to foresee the kind of smartphone addiction that so many people feel, and that we're feeling like the technology is hurting our mental health instead of improving it? So I'm working with the Institute for the Future to develop these future forecasting games so that we have a chance to think about things like self-driving cars and augmented reality and virtual reality and automation of jobs, and really kind of get ahead of where these technologies might take us so that we can predict what might go wrong and brainstorm solutions and strategies before we wake up in a future that we don't want to actually be living in.
So look ahead. I mean, things have progressed so quickly over the years. What do you see in the future of gaming like 10, 20 years from now?
I definitely see, especially in virtual reality, there will be a lot of really important strategic applications of virtual reality and gaming in VR. Specifically, there's been so much research and clinical application of how it can be used to treat pain. So you can reduce the number of prescriptions for addictive pain medications, lower the side effects. We're seeing virtual reality is having really amazing use in hospice situations. So for people who are at the end of life and they still have these places they wish they had been able to go or experiences they wish they'd been able to have in their real life, using VR to kind of bring those experiences into our minds as if we really had lived them. So I think there's a lot of really exciting strategic application for how we can reduce suffering and use these technologies to improve our quality of life in really meaningful ways that are not just about escaping the real world, but actually bringing benefit to the people who use the technologies.
Jane McGonigal is a video game designer, author, and public speaker. Several of her essays can be found on TED.com. Still to come, a university professor in Florida has been named to the state's new cybersecurity task force. We'll meet her next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. On October 1st, the new State of Florida Cybersecurity Task Force convened for the first time. The task force is chaired by the state's Lieutenant Governor, Jeanette Nunez, and includes the state's Chief Information Officer, Chief Information Security Officer, and representatives from the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and Division of Cybersecurity Management. Business and healthcare leaders from the private sector will also participate. It also includes one member of academia. That's Dr. Iman Al-Sheikh, a professor of computer science at the University of West Florida and the director of the university's Center for Cybersecurity. I spoke with Dr. Al-Sheikh about her appointment.
Thank you. I'm truly honored to be nominated to serve on the Cybersecurity Task Force for the state of Florida. It's great for higher education as well as for our region and the University of West Florida. The task force's mission is to review the state's cybersecurity infrastructure, operations, and governance, and provide recommendations on how we can improve the state cybersecurity assets and how we can help state government advance our cybersecurity efforts and resiliency.
What are some of the challenges you think you'd be focusing on?
Well, certainly the main issue is always the evolving cyber threat landscape. So we continue to see complex cyber threats coming from various sources. And of course, at the state level, we are talking about the information of our citizens, the data and information of our citizens. So it's very important to the mission and the economic prosperity of our state to make sure that we have the best infrastructure and operations and policies to maintain and advance our cybersecurity resiliency. And more importantly, to look at the future. How can we continue to plan strategically to not just kind of keep ahead of the adversaries and keep cyber threats at bay, but also to really advance Florida as a leader in cybersecurity?
You mentioned something I was going to talk about, too, is cybersecurity. It's always a moving target, isn't it?
Absolutely. So we certainly want to make sure that we review, you know, tools and technologies and best practices, and also look at, as you mentioned, the, you know, evolving state of the cyber threats. Every new attack or breach comes a little differently, right? There's a little more information or something different about it. And so the more we keep up to date with what's happening across, certainly not just our state, but also this is a matter of national security. And the more we can kind of keep ahead in terms of planning to stay ahead of all that.
Does that have to be an aspect now, you think, going forward with so many different aspects of life?
Absolutely. Everything we do right now is in some way has a digital component to it. And once we start talking about digital, then the aspect of keeping everything digital secure comes into play. And so at the center, what we always talk about as our two main overarching goals are build a culture of cybersecurity from the ground up. So everybody starting with our elementary school students, our kindergarten students need to have a sense of cyber hygiene and what to do when you're on an iPad or laptop or tablet, because there are risks there. The second thing we talk about is cybersecurity is everyone's business. Whether we're talking individually or for your organization, everybody has a responsibility and role to be cyber safe and cyber aware. And whether we're talking about large enterprise organizations or small to medium-sized businesses, they all have sensitive and protected and critical data that needs to be secure. And as you mentioned, it runs across every sector, whether it's finance, healthcare, defense, retail, hospitality, everything requires some element of cybersecurity. So it's really our responsibility individually and collectively to make sure that we're all up to date and up to speed on how to be cyber safe and cyber aware.
It's weird. I had to write a check last week, and I almost forgot how. You pay everything online, and yet that cybersecurity is a part of everyday life. A master's student leaves in cybersecurity. 5 years later, they come back and say, everything's changed. I got to start over again.
I'm so glad you asked that question, because one of the initiatives that the center just launched is the Cybersecurity for All program. It's intended for those looking to get in or advance in a cybersecurity degree, as well as for organizations to help either ramp up new personnel or upskill and reskill existing workforce. Because as you mentioned, the world of cybersecurity moves very rapidly. The jobs of tomorrow, the jobs of 5 years, haven't even yet been created in the sense of how quickly this is moving. And so the Cyber for All program provides flexible, short, hands-on courses that are open to individuals in the public, that are open to organizations, so that they can get in or get up to speed without cybersecurity, without having to go back and get a cyber degree. We started that as a President Saunders' Next Big Thing initiative, really looking at the needs across Northwest Florida. There are about 1,100 unfilled cybersecurity jobs across our Northwest Florida counties as we speak. And the solution to fill all those jobs can't be to ask individuals to go back to school and get a four-year degree or a graduate degree, because as you mentioned, by the time they're done, it'll have evolved. And so what we need is, in addition to our academic programs, quick, agile, flexible, short courses that really get people the skills they need for the jobs in the area.
Have you been contacted by other institutions, either in state or around the country, about, you know, setting up a cybersecurity program, how it was done, and try to pick your brains?
Yes. The university is a National Center of Academic Excellence in Cyber Defense Education. That is a designation that is provided by the National Security Agency and Department of Homeland Security. And it is really, within the higher ed world, the gold star of quality of education. And we're honored to serve as the Southeast hub for centers of academic excellence. So the center's role actually broadcasts much farther out than Pensacola, Northwest Florida. We help institutions across Florida, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Mississippi, and Puerto Rico develop their cyber program. So we're working with about 12 colleges and universities across the Southeast right now, mentoring them to develop cybersecurity programs and eventually apply to become centers of academic excellence. And we also provide professional development to institutions that are already centers of academic excellence, because as you mentioned earlier, their faculty need to keep up to date. And so what we try to do is figure out what are the next cutting-edge topics in cybersecurity going to be, and provide workshops for faculty across the Southeast to attend.
That's a lot of eyes over your shoulder.
Yes, it is. It really is. And it's I always tell students that that's what motivates us to keep doing this, is that it's really about helping our community, where from our perspective, we look at community across multiple dimensions. We look at Pensacola and Northwest Florida. We look at the state of Florida. We look at the Southeast region, and we look at the national cybersecurity community, because it ultimately is the greatest mission in the world to be able to help secure our communities and, you know, help our nation secure our assets.
So what's next for you on the task force? Are there cyber meetings, or do you all get together in one room?
Yeah. So again, honored to be appointed to the task force. The next step will be an initial meeting of the task force members to really review our charge from the governor. The task force is, my understanding, going to be tasked to provide recommendations on how to enhance cybersecurity operations, infrastructure, and governance for the state. And then we'll meet periodically as a task force to look at the existing challenges, opportunities, technologies, threats, and come up with recommendations over the next year.
I imagine somewhere the election's going to come up in some of those meetings.
Yes, that's certainly a very important aspect of our state security is critical infrastructure, including election security. We've been fortunate that we've had the opportunity to support the state agencies as well as the Department of State on training for cybersecurity for election supervisors in the past. That's a service that we provided to the Florida Department of State last year, and we're certainly very interested in continuing to support their efforts moving forward.
All right. And how long are you on this for?
The task force is being convened for a year with the goal of providing recommendations at the end of the year.
Okay, great. What didn't I ask you that people should know?
I would just remind everyone that cybersecurity needs to be everyone's business. It can't be just the one person in your family who knows IT well. It can't be just the one person on your team at work who is the IT tech support. It's really our own responsibility to make sure whatever we're using, whether it's a phone, a laptop, we're aware of what we're sharing and why and how, and trying to make sure that we're taking responsibility as citizens to protect our information. Because we're all nodes in this interconnected world. We all become nodes on the network.
Dr. Iman Al-Sheikh is a professor of computer science at the University of West Florida and is the director of the university's Center for Cybersecurity. She is the only academic on the new State of Florida Cybersecurity Task Force. As we heard earlier, virtual reality is the future of video gaming. It could also be the future of job interviews. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Virtual reality isn't just for gaming. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, J.J. Rosella, associate professor of theater at Shenandoah University, logs into a new way to use this technology.
For people with intellectual disabilities, a job interview can create extreme anxiety. Social interaction and the fear of the unknown is often debilitating. Virtual reality reduces this fear by creating a no-risk situation. VR eliminates mystery by recreating the world the person will be confronting in the future. Through our research, we've taken people with intellectual disabilities through a 7-part virtual job interview process. During the virtual experience, an interviewer, played by a professional role player, establishes the participant in their new virtual world by greeting them, reinforcing who they are, where they are, and why they are there. The role player helps guide the individual through what they should wear in their interview, their approach to the interview, and the kinds of questions they might be asked. The next step is to conduct a group job interview in which the role player interviews multiple intellectually disabled individuals. This situation removes putting individuals on the spot, allowing them to be able to model their answers after their peers. A one-on-one interview is next, followed by a self-review in VR of the interview. Through our research, we found that VR encourages higher functionality for those with cognitive disabilities. Participants are able to learn soft skills, like making eye contact and shaking hands. They gain confidence. One participant who was normally unable to socially engage put on the headset and held a 5-minute conversation. The virtual world is where they're comfortable. We believe that through this kind of virtual training, we can create an untapped labor force by empowering individuals who may have always wanted to work, but have been unable to even take the first step.
That was J.J. Rosella of Shenandoah University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Thank you.